Football on the Sports Social Podcast Network is brought to you by BetVictor. Don't like your odds? Enjoy daily bet boosts on your favourite sports and make your best bet now at BetVictor.com. 18 plus BeGambleAware.org.
The Wonder Goal. Hello and welcome to episode 15 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's one up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Matthew. So Matthew, how have you been since we last spoke?
I've been pretty good. Obviously, last week was Thanksgiving over here in the US. So let's just say that I'm thankful for club football to be back, especially after the international break and the ringer that Wales put me through. And thankful to be talking to you all about it.
Top man. Right, before we chat all things football, I best do the social media bits first, or as we'll be talking into the abyss once more. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. Check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E, you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. Where should we go first? Let's go to Goodison Park again. And although the protests of the Everton game beforehand made some headlines, it was Alejandro Gamacho's goal which was turning heads. Matthew, have we already seen the goal of the season in November?
I think that's a pretty fair shout. I mean, I can't remember exactly every single guy. I'm sure that, you know, some Man City fan pointing out will point to, you know, a Rodri strike or, you know, something like that, or, you know, a Haaland strike they've had at some point this season. But yeah, I think it's pretty fair. I think, you know, bicycle kicks often sort of they're a bit hard to judge. Like, who know whose was better? Was it Wayne Rooney's, you know, against Man City all those years ago? But I think when you look at Garnacho's goal, when you look at, you know, the angle, you know, how far he was away from goal, and the fact that he managed to put it in the perfect spot to sort of loop it over the goalkeeper. I think it's going to be very, very hard to beat that this season.
Well, of course, you know, goal of the season is always subjective. It's whether you prefer the 35-yard screamer or the bicycle kick. There's, you know, there's different flavours of goals. You mentioned Wayne Rooney, so the big question is, which one was better, Wayne Rooney's against Manchester City or Garnacho against Everton?
See, the thing that everyone goes on about Wayne Rooney is the fact that it hit his shin, and it may not have been as impressive as some people might have thought it could be. Given the angle and how far away it was, I think I'd have to give it to Garnacho, personally. Although everyone's saying, like, it's the greatest. No, I saw someone on Twitter saying it was the greatest bicycle kick they've ever seen, as if Zlatan Ibrahimovic is against England from outside the box and from about 35 yards out, just didn't exist. So. Yeah, so I don't want anyone to get carried away with it, but yeah, it was a very, very good goal.
Yeah, I think the danger, as always, it's recency bias, isn't it? You know, just because it's fresh in the memory, it instantly becomes the best goal you've ever seen. And as you say, like Zlatan, we'll be thinking, hang on, like my effort against England was not only from 35 yards out, it was near the touchline, wasn't it? It was a stupendous effort, and really that's going to be in the pantheon of great bicycle kicks. But, you know, also, I guess the flip side to Garnacho is Rooney's was in a Manchester derby, so there's a bit more behind it. But I think technique, position, even Pickford having to try and make the save added to the vision of the goal and so on and so forth. So I think we're going to give it to Garnacho. But let's focus on the match itself now. We spoke about Everton last week in depth, and we sort of spoke about, is this going to be the game where the fan base is galvanised and that leads to the team? There was obviously a lot of noise beforehand and a lot of activity in the first half for Everton. Come the second half, though, they clearly run out of puff.
Yeah, I think part of that might have been, you know, we talked about the, you know, the fervent atmosphere and everything that would have, you know, that could have been at, you know, the protests around the Premier League and the getting back to the Premier League football and all that sort of stuff. I honestly just think the fact that the Garnacho goal came within, what, 2 or 3 minutes, just quieted everything down, just shut everything down. And after that, they were facing an uphill battle. Because we sort of said, you know, if you want to look for, you know, if this was ideally the perfect game for Everton, we talk about the atmosphere. Man United are not, you know, they can be got on occasions. So you think, right, if this is going to be the game we're going to, you know, get back on track and, you know, start clawing back those points, then this would be a very good game to do it. But once you take the life out of them in the, you know, in the first couple of minutes, then it's an uphill battle. And, you know, whilst Man United are a side that can be got, we know that on their day they can produce some very good performances, and this was one of them. So once they got, you know, once they got their noses in front, it was always going to be hard for Everton to get back in. As you said, it just showed during the second half as they ran out of steam.
Well, we mentioned last week about them being 2 points from safety after the deduction, and we kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, nothing's really changed. Obviously, they have moved down the table, but safety is still obtainable. But the combination of results that we've seen over the weekend has made the task harder in an instant, because 2 points from safety is now five. So when you look at where Everton are, can you take that performance against Manchester United as a defining performance, or has they still got enough in the tank to get past the likes of Luton and Bournemouth?
No, I think they might start to look more at the other results. I think, as I say, Man United are still a very good team. They still have World Cup players. They are susceptible to the odd bad result. I think they should probably be more concerned with the likes of what Bournemouth did, for instance, and being able to pull away, you know, a team they thought maybe in their relegation battle, or Luton picking up their win. Oh, right, now they're starting to get their feet from underneath them. So I think if Everton are going to be worried, I think they should be worried about results elsewhere rather than just focusing on themselves. Because if they, you know, cause if we all thought that, you know, Sheffield United and all the teams down the bottom are going to stay down the bottom, but if a couple of those sides start picking up results, then all of a sudden it becomes a lot harder for Everton, and they think, right, it's not just going to be, you know, us bundling our way through and just, you know, being the fourth worst team, as it were.
Yeah, I guess the magnitude of the defeat is enlarged by the fact that Luton and Bournemouth both got wins at the weekend. Does that mean that Everton now just have to consider themselves in a mini league with those two teams and kind of not even really worry about Sheffield United and Burnley, because you get the feeling they're not going to get the better of Everton? It's them looking up the table.
Yeah, I think that's fair. As you say, a mini league, I think that is what Everton have put themselves into this season, if you want to include the likes of Nottingham Forest in there as well. As long as they can get the results against those teams, then they should be able to consider themselves in with a fighting chance. Because I think we might be past the point, especially results that, you know, when we said at the start of the season there might be two teams that challenged Derby's 11 points. You know, I think it was Luton, Sheffield United and everything. I think we've probably gone past that point, and the teams probably look to be a little bit more competitive than that. But I think so long as Everton can get the results against that lot, then they should be able to, again, just about sneak their way through.
And in terms of getting results, Manchester United, they've won 5 from 6 now. Although the football is far from perfect under Erik ten Hag at the moment, it's also 3 clean sheets in a row in the league. And that's something that shouldn't be overlooked at the moment.
No, it shouldn't, especially with all the questions that we had about, you know, Andre Onana, and who had some very good saves on the weekend. You know, maybe it is just a case of, right, they've just got to all bed in, you know, bed in together, get used to each other, and, you know, be a little bit stronger in front of Onana, because we know that he is susceptible to some mistakes. So yeah, the fact that they are now starting to get that, you know, one of the key things sorted out, then it should give them a little bit of confidence. But at the same time, you just still have to worry about their, you know, the mental side of things, because there are still a couple of results that they will drop all of a sudden, and you hope they just want to minimise that as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a strange record for Manchester United. They're yet to draw a game in the Premier League, and you think to yourself, if they're a little bit more pragmatic in some of their performances where they lost, you know, even just an extra point on the table might have helped their cause. But the fact it's kind of feast or famine at the moment for Manchester United, it's hard to really get a gauge of how good they are, because as you say, you get a feeling a defeat is always going to be around the corner. And even though they're not losing matches with regularity at the moment, they're not really blowing teams away. Everton may be aside, but you kind of look at Manchester United, you think, are they a top four team at the moment? Perhaps not, but if they keep just sort of winning every, I don't know, 3 out of 4 games and not losing, it might be the one thing that even gets them back into the top four. But let's look at the bottom four, because the two teams that are making life hard for Everton, one of them is Luton. They made history with the first home win in the Premier League. And I think it's fair to say, Matthew, they are starting to bed into this division, and no longer are Rob Edwards' men considered the whipping boys of the division.
No, I think, you know, as I say, you know, if It wasn't nice to talk about Luton and Sheffield United, Luton and Sheffield United as the as the challengers for Derby, but we just sort of knew there was a realistic chance that could happen because of the squad they've got. But I think it does make the Premier League a little bit better because as much as we don't want to see teams like Man City pulling away and winning the league by the start of April, I don't think it's as fun as well to see a team being cut adrift and absolutely relegation certainties in November. So as you say, the fact that they are, as you say, no longer the whipping boys and can actually put themselves about and challenge a couple of teams and make it competitive, then yeah, it does make the Premier League a much better product rather.
Well, yes, if we look at Luton's last six matches, they picked up 5 of their 9 points of the season in that sample. They have lost 3 of those 6 matches, but I think the important thing to take from this is when they are losing, they're not getting absolutely hammered. It's not like an 8-0 that Sheffield United suffered earlier in the season that has in Newcastle. They've lost 1-0 to Manchester United. I can't remember. They lost 1-0 at home to Tottenham. There was a 3-1 defeat somewhere along the line. But, it's not really sort of defeats that are confidence knocking. Yes, they're losing, but they are managing to then pick themselves up the next game and get a point on the board. That's going to be something that Rob Edwards and his players can build on.
Yeah, it is, exactly. The fact that they are somewhat competitive in games, it's a theory that I've often had. When you look at goal difference in the Premier League, you can often tell roughly where a team is by their goal difference as much as their points. Because if a team is like Sheffield United, it's minus 25, then or whatever it is right now, then that shows they're not competitive in games, regardless of what their points are. But if it's like minus 4. Then, okay, they've managed to score a bunch of goals, they managed to keep it, and they are competing. So just you've got to tweak a couple of things and then you'll be able to turn those losses into draws and draws into wins. So as you say, the fact they are tight in games, even if they're not winning, then that maybe come January, February, especially if they are able to make some acquisitions in the transfer window, then they might be able to make it more competitive at the turn of the season.
Yeah, I mean, who knows where they'll be come May, because even now, being outside the bottom three is relative success, and it's something that they can build on. And now they're out the bottom three, they'll think, well, actually, we can hold our own in this league, and we're not certainties to go down, especially with the Everton situation in the mix as well. But if we look at the team they beat, that being Crystal Palace, I mean, it's going to be a frustrating afternoon for Michael Olise himself, because his goal counted for nothing in the grand scheme of the game. Not only that, he probably thought he scored the goal of the season himself on Saturday. Come Sunday, it's second.
It was. Michael Olise, an incredible player for Crystal Palace, and you just got to hope that something like that it shouldn't be a knock on his confidence, but we've always looked at who can be the next man for Crystal Palace after the Zaha. Some people said it may have been Eberechi Eze, but I think Olise is probably taking that mantle. Not saying more than Eberechi Eze, but I think it's a battle between the two. To be the talisman, I think Olise is probably just edging that battle right this moment, and it shows with his incredible goal.
Yeah, it's an incredible goal. I think for Olise, in terms of being the next Zaha, I think output has to improve, because it was a surprising stat that was his first goal since January. And I know there's been an injury in that period, obviously the off-season as well, so it's not as bad as the stat perhaps sounds, but it's still a bit too long for someone who wants to be the king at Selhurst Park. So, if that part of his game can be introduced even further, then Palace have got a real talent on their hands, and they're going to need talent on their hands because they've lost one due to long-term injury. That being Cheick Doucouré, 6 months is going to be the prognosis in terms of injury absence. Now, when you look at his absence and Crystal Palace's position, it's not nuclear, it's not the doom and gloom just yet, but with the way Palace are playing, are they already in a holding pattern between the end of the season, or do they themselves have to worry about looking over their shoulders and a potential relegation battle?
I think losing someone like Doucouré, I'd say not nuclear, but it is enough to make you say, right, we could maybe drop a point down the a place down the table. Like, again, go back to Zaha. If they'd have lost Zaha many moons ago, that would have cost them 5 places in the league table, so to speak. Whereas I think someone like Doucouré, again, it's an important one. It's an important player to miss, but I don't think it's going to be crucial. And yeah, I think probably someone they might look to replace in the January transfer window, because he is an important player. He will cost them a little bit, but I don't think it's necessarily panic stations just yet for Palace.
If you look at the wider picture of Crystal Palace, though, it is 4 league defeats from 5. So there's already murmurs that people aren't enjoying the Hodgson brand of football again. You know, we saw the almost non-Hodgson football at the back end of the last season when the reins were looser, but then we're back into that kind of safety-first approach, the pragmatism that Hodgson is known for. It's obviously working to a certain degree because they're not a Sheffield United, they're not a Burnley. But what do they need to be doing this season? Or is it because the season is such a different one in terms of the relegation battle that even just sort of coasting to 16th, 17th is not going to be too much of an issue? What do you reckon?
I think they might they might need to change. I think Roy Hodgson is probably going to have to revert to type, as it were. I don't think they're going to be dragged deep into a relegation battle again. Then they may be flirting around like 15th, 16th. At some point in the season, and only like 4 points off the drop. But I think when you look at the teams that are around them, I think Crystal Palace, at least on paper, have the better players and do have the adaptability to change their style a little bit better to suit the more, you know, Roy Hodgson defensive style if they need to. So I think they should be okay for the most part.
Yeah, I think they'll be okay. I don't think it's going to be any spectacular season, but if you offer them 15th now to Palace supporters, I think they take it, knowing that it's another season in the Premier League. Hopefully that new stand gets built, the funds come, so on and so forth. It just feels like the club's in a holding pattern. It just needs some ignition spark, really. And it just, whether that comes with a new manager next season, with new ideas. But, you know, how many times can you keep relying on Roy Hodgson? They've got to get the next appointment right, because they tried before with Frank de Boer with a change of style. That fell flat. Vieira ran out of steam in terms of his appointment. So it's an interesting phase at Crystal Palace, one they've got to get right, because they can't keep just swimming on the surface. You know, it will get them eventually in terms of the tide. So we'll just have to watch this space, I guess, over the next sort of year or two rather than the next couple of months. But in terms of choppy waters, Bournemouth are sailing out of theirs. It's another win for them against Sheffield United. Is it fair to say that Cherry's ball could be vindicated for not panicking in terms of managerial personnel, as now they are reaping the benefits of Andoni Areola?
I think they can be, but again, at the same time, I think most results need to be taken into their context. Like, this is, again, I don't want to disrespect them, but we've seen how results have gone. It was against Sheffield United, so you would expect even a struggling Bournemouth team to do well against them. But as you say, they are starting to get little decent results put together, and, you know, vindicated. We'll sort of have to wait and see whether or not this is, you know, whether or not this works out in the long term, or whether or not he's just got lucky in the fact that there are some very bad teams in the Premier League this season, whereas other, you know, in other years they'd be in Sheffield United's place for all we know. So some extra context needed, but yeah, I think things are starting to click, and hopefully can produce something in the longer run.
Yeah, I think you make a fair point in that, you know, without being too dismissive, it was only Sheffield United. And when you look at the way that Sheffield United conceded that second goal, West Forringham mistake coming out the box, losing possession, it's kind of proof positive. And when things aren't going for you, they really do go against you.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, when you're a team like that, you can't really afford to be taking chances. And I get that, you know, maybe it worked for them in the Championship when they were a good team. But when it comes to the Premier League and you are the underdogs and you are the lesser team, there are some chances that you just can't afford to be taking and messing around with. You know, if you're a Manuel Neuer, for instance, you can get away with something like that, because, you know, if you give up a goal, that they're going to go and score three down the other end to make up for it. But when you're Sheffield United, a goal like that could pretty much be a game changer, and you're not going to get back into it, as they showed.
Well, they certainly didn't get into the game on Saturday. And when you look at their league position, it's 18th. They're above Everton. But when you look at Paul Heckingbottom's men, the worry is about where they get the next 3 points from. Because, to add some context, were it not for the Toffees' point deduction, the Blades would currently be 7 points from safety. So although Everton sit below Sheffield United, if you were to pick one of those two teams and say who's going to win their next game of football the soonest, surely you'd be picking Everton regardless of their new position.
Yeah, you would. I mean, for a lot of players, I think on a player-per-player basis, you would pick Everton over Sheffield United. I think when it comes to the managers as well, whilst I would trust Sean Dyche in the Premier League more than I would trust Paul Heckingbottom. So, yeah, they certainly do have the better resource, and that could eventually show them. You know, that's why I say Everton could eventually find themselves pulling away from the likes of Sheffield United, assuming they get their act together.
Well, on the flip side, they are only 4 points from safety. So do you get the feeling that this is what the Blades board are banking on? That, yes, they've only got 5 points, but the bar to get out of the relegation zone is only 9 at the moment. So because they're not cast adrift, even with such a small points tally, there's no real need to panic just yet.
Yeah, so long as they're close enough, and you know, we wonder whether or not they'll be able to invest in, you know, in the winter rather. Whether or not they're the kind of owners that will do that, especially if they are only 4 points, which isn't an insurmountable gap to get. I think again, the bar for staying up this season is looking like it is going to be incredibly low. So as long as they can keep themselves within touching distance, and they're not like 10 points adrift, then you'd imagine they would find themselves in a position where they think, right, we can get out of this by hook or by crook.
I guess the nature of us as football fans, we look at the points won, don't we? And we say, oh, Heckingbottom's only won 5 points out of what, 39. He's having a dreadful season. But as we are just alluding to now, even with 5 points, they're still in touching distance of being relegated. In any other season, if they had 5 points, they'd be cast adrift at the bottom. Heckingbottom would probably be long gone by now. But we are in just a non kind of basic standard season, and that's what's keeping Heckingbottom in his job.
I think it is, you know, I can very easily see a point where, you know, come January, there are, you know, 4 teams that haven't even got to 15, 20 points yet this season. So, yeah, it does play into the favour of a couple of teams a little bit, because, as you say, in a normal season, they may be cut adrift and, you know, and as you say, Paul Heckingbottom would be gone. But they know that it's going to be bad, and, you know, we may be one of the bad teams. But as long as we can just outlast 3 of them, then we're in a good position. They obviously feel that they may have enough faith in him to, you know, to turn around, even if that means, you know, 27 points at the end of the season. As long as the team in 18th has 26, then that's all okay.
Well, I was going to ask about the magic 40-point marker. I mean, there's no way that's going to be enforced this season. So do you reckon it could be as low as 30?
I think 30 might even be a bit too high.
Really?
I think we've said this a couple of times. I think in the COVID season, when we came up, everyone was talking about, you know, 25 might be it with, oh, who came up with us? Leeds and I can't remember who came up with us. I think it was Sheffield United, but don't quote me on that. That everyone said, oh, the way the squad isn't going to be worth it. Actually, to light, it was West Brom that came up with this, but the point stands. I think everyone assumes that there can be, you know, there have been seasons where people say, oh, 25 can do it. I think this might be the season in which it happens.
Okay, there was no VAR contention at Bramall Lane, but there's certainly going to be some in our next talking point, because Matthew, you picked up on the story that FIFA want to expand on VAR's remit. For better or worse, what's your take on the matter?
Well, I think this was always going to be inevitable, because the talks are that they're going to expand what can be reviewed for things like free kicks and rather than just, you know, goals, offside, handballs, and all the stuff that it covers now. And I think this was inevitably going to be the end point, because I always felt like, right, why shouldn't VAR be able to challenge check on everything? Because it was the first instance that it really came up was, it was again during the COVID season. It was West Ham were playing Man United, and Man United scored when a ball went down the wing, and everyone was curious whether or not the ball had gone out of touch.
Yeah, I remember.
Match of the day showed later on that it did, but VAR is a thing they couldn't check on. So it was always, that was one of the talking points to say, right, are we going to get there? I think there was always going to be a point where they say, right, everything is going to be challenged or be able to be reviewed by VAR. And at that point is where we bring up the other talking point that a lot of people make comparisons to, and that's the challenge system that they have in the NFL, where I think that's going to be it, where coaches get given whatever number you want to give, you know, 2 challenges a half, 5 a game, 6 a game, whatever number you want. There is going to come a time where they're going to say, right, anything is up for grabs, but we're leaving it up to you. So we're going to take the referee and the VAR out of the decision-making. It's, do you want to check this? Do you want to risk this? Do you want to, you know, is, now, if an offside is given in the first 30 seconds of the game, do you want to overrule that, or do you want to, you know, risk not being able to challenge something later on in the game? I think that is where it is going to go. If you're going to open it up to everything, which I think was always going to be the case, fine. But everyone saying, oh, this is going to lead to, you know, games going on for, you know, 2 hours, you know, 2.5 hours with all the delays if they're checking everything. I think the one way to get rid of that is just to say, right, yep, everything's up to grabs, but we're only going to have a maximum of four checks or whatever, four checks a game. And that's on to you guys, the managers, you decide when you want to do it. So I think that's where we're leading to.
Okay, that raises a good point, actually. I was going to lead into this with my next question in terms of timing, because we're already seeing 100-plus minute matches, and that's not including the time you've seen the first half. So that extra 10 minutes in second half alone. Your point about the challenge system, if managers are regulated to two a match, let's say, or two a half, let's be a bit generous, would that then make sure the game is not leaking into stupendous amounts of time? There's more of a framework. So yes, VAR is more open, but the use of it is minimalised to counteract that.
Yeah, I think because again, there might be the instances where, again, managers are holding on to their decisions. Because again, there may be a game where there's three VAR checks in the first half in a normal situation like we have now. But if managers are holding on to their thing and say, right, no, I don't, that's not worth challenging, an offside thing. So, okay, we've got enough time to get back into the game. I'm going to hold on to this rather than have it be checked. So first halves are going to sort of be a little quicker as well. And then, yeah, just put it onto the second half. I think, yeah, that is a way that's going to, again, just speed up the game more than, you know, as we see the 100-plus minute situations that we have now. I think that will be one of the key ways in which you speed the game up.
Yeah, actually, I quite like the sound of this. I guess to use parallels in other sports, cricket, you get the review system, but I think you only get a maximum of three in an innings. And I think if you are correct in using your review, you don't lose that one. But if you are incorrect in your review, that gets spent. So I think that's something that could be brought forward. But then again, you know, I think you need to cap it at some level for football. But I guess also with basketball timeouts, that yes, you can use a timeout at any stage, but you see a lot more timeouts in the fourth quarter. So I guess from a manager's point of view, you have to be a lot more tactical in your usage of these challenges and probably bookend them at the back of the game, knowing that you might need that late offside to go in your favour.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's where I think the strategy of it is. For some reason, I remember talking about this about 5 years ago when talks about chances. There will always be someone who will try to rig the system, you know. And for some reason, Jose Mourinho's name always comes up. But there will be a time where he's leading in the 89th minute, say 1-0. And he'll want to challenge whether or not the ball came off the player for a throw-in or something. Just so he can, right, whilst the VAR's going on, he can pass on some messages to the players or give his players a minute's rest or something. There will always be an excuse for, you know, coaches to manipulate it and use it in their favour or something. But again, if we're looking for the game to be sped back up, which is what FIFA, you know, talk about, you know, wasted minutes and everything, and that's why we have all these all this injury time go on. If we want to speed the game back up, then I think a challenge system, you know, to get everything reviewed, I think would be the best way to go about it.
Yeah, and you make a good point about Mourinho and gaming the system, but I guess at least everyone would be able to game the system. It's just that those managers that are world class will find the grey area and know how to use it. So it's not a case of Mourinho being punished for doing that. It's almost a case of, well, the scope is there, so you shouldn't really be bemoaning him. It's like, well, if everyone's in the same framework, why aren't other managers doing it as well?
Yeah, and I don't want to use Jose Mourinho example, but when it comes to managers using certain tactics to their advantage and finding loopholes, who's the first name do you think of? It's Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't want to use him as the pantheon, as the great example of this, but there is a fact that there will be some managers, and you just know Jose will probably be leading the line.
Absolutely. Right, VAR was kept rather busy on Sunday in North London. Heung-min Song was deprived a hat-trick of offside goals, but, you know, at least they were legitimate decisions, so no bugbear for me. Tottenham were eventually deprived a point at the hands of Aston Villa. Matthew, I know you're not a Tottenham fan, but if you were watching it from a Tottenham lens, even though they did lose 2-1, can you take positives from that game performance, considering the lineup and its formation was a bit of a, well, let's just pick 11 fit players and all we've got?
Yeah, I think we sort of discussed is that it was always going to be hard for Tottenham with the, you know, with the squad they have, and, you know, whilst we credit Ange Postecoglou for, you know, for the start that he's managed to get with the side, that his managerial ability would be tested in a situation like this, with, as you say, just put 11 fit players out on the pitch. So whilst you don't want to say, you know, this is a big loss for for Spurs, especially because it's Aston Villa, and this could, in theory, be a team that, you know, is challenging them for fourth, fifth place in the Premier League. So you don't want to lose, you know, arguably a 6-pointer, but you don't want it, but you can to an extent to sort of wipe it off and say, right, we managed to hold our own with 11 fit players with whatever we were able to scramble together, and on another day with fit players, we might have been able to get a point or maybe even a win.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There is the caveat of all these injuries. I guess there's no doubt the football is exciting for Tottenham, and Tottenham fans are certainly refreshed and revived after 2-3 dour seasons under Mourinho and Conte. Is there the trap, though, that Tottenham all of a sudden become this team of plucky losers that, yes, the football is exciting, but they're kind of using that, oh, well, at least we're playing well lines, a get-out clause for not winning matches?
I think there is that. I think with someone like Postecoglou, I think that you are sort of getting, there is the danger of being swept up in, you know, because Ange Postecoglou is a nice man. Everyone loves him in the press conference and everything. Oh, it's okay. You know, he's a great guy, and that sort of washes over some of the bad results and maybe the odd tactical decision that he gets wrong. So, yeah, I think there is a danger of just sort of slipping, of letting that slip and just, you know, as you say, moving on from the Mourinho and Conte dullness. That, yes, the football is exciting, but there is going to come a time like this stretch where, okay, but we want the results to come along with it. And if they're not coming, then the good football isn't really worth it.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of, it shouldn't be an either or, but at the moment it's kind of good football is trumping everything. But you have to remember that's now 0 points from 9 on the table. And that's kind of feeding into a narrative already of Tottenham bottling any potential title chase or their own in-house celebrations that they may have had a month or so ago. So, you know, it's easy to sort of sit on one side of the fence or the other. Obviously, if you're a non-Tottenham fan, you can use the Spursy, the bottling, so on and so forth. Is this really, at the moment, Tottenham's just genuine level of where you may even expect them to be? And even top five is kind of above expectations at the start of the campaign, that due to their start of the season was so ahead of the curve that anything dropping off is going to be seen as failure by any other fan. So are Tottenham getting sort of almost beaten by their own stick of progress early on?
I think that's fair, because I think we knew that it was going to be hard for someone like Tottenham to get into the Champions League, especially if we assumed Liverpool were going to sort themselves out, which it looks as if they have. If Chelsea were going to sort themselves out, which can go either way depending on them. With Newcastle, with their money now that they're back in the Champions League, that's a team that takes up a top four space. It was always going to be hard for them to get into the top four, but with how they started, you might think, oh, it's possible. But now he's saying maybe a time to just reassess of what this is, especially this is the season after Harry Kane has left, and has all the investment been spent in the right way, and is there still money to come from Daniel Levy and the overs and everything like that? So yeah, I think it is there. I think a reassessment is fair at this point, because you might have been swept away with the fast start, but we knew that there were always going to be limitations to this Spurs side, and I think like Europa League football would probably be about where you would expect this team to be. But as you say, the fact they were challenging for Champions League and top of the table and everything may have just blinded everyone to what this Tottenham squad really is.
I think it goes back to that point of ambition is more of a fluid concept rather than a fixed target. Because if you are, let's take Arsenal last season, obviously top for so many days and then they finished second, and Arsenal fans were selling it as, well, you know, we only finished top five the season before. Champions League would have been a bonus the following season, that being last season, obviously. But you can't really go back on that when you've been top of the table for so long. So if Tottenham were to be sailing top of the table up until March, then collapse, then it's fair to sort of beat them with the, oh, they've collapsed again stick. But if they are swimming around fourth, fifth, sixth the rest of the season, then as you say, Europa League football is pretty much par with any real objective, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Again, especially given how competitive things are. I think many people thought Aston Villa would be challenging for Europe. I don't think many people would have expected them to be challenging for Champions League seriously on a basis. So yeah, as you say, it is fluid, and you've got to take it with just how well you are going through fits and starts. As you said, Europa League probably would be a bonus and would be progress for Spurs. But if they're third all the way up until March and then drop into the Europa League, then you might think, oh, it's an opportunity missed. So I think with a team like Spurs, especially given how fluid the top six, seven, eight can be, I think assessments really do need to whatchamacallit, or ambitions need to be challenged on a sort of weekly, or not weekly, but a monthly basis.
Well, let's look at Aston Villa now, because we keep talking about their ceiling. It's gone from top six to top four. I'm going to ask it, Matthew. They're 2 points off the pace. Can they win the title?
What, Aston Villa win the title?
Yeah.
No.
No?
I like it. I understand where you're coming from, but no, I just can't see it, although I'm pretty sure I made the same comments about Leicester. I mean, it would be great. I'm not denying it would be great to see someone like Aston Villa go and win the title, but I just can't see that squad outlasting the Man City's and the Liverpool's and the Arsenal's personally. But as I say, it would be nice.
Okay, let me try and sell you the concept just a little bit more, because they have the best home form in the division at the moment. Last six matches, 18 points. You can't ask any more than that. Their home form, sorry, that away form isn't the best, but the home form is absorbing that indifference away from Villa Park. At the same time, though, overall, they are the second joint highest goal scorers in the division at the moment. Can I not tempt you with at least a top four finish?
A top four finish, you can tempt me, and I will hear the argument for. You have stunned me at 10:15 in the morning. I've only been awake an hour, and now you're throwing Aston Villa to win the title. Again, if you were throwing this to me earlier, you know, later in the afternoon, I might be more susceptible to it. But that's not something I was expecting to hear before 10:00. That Aston Villa could go on and win the title. But I appreciate the theory.
Okay.
But yeah, come back to me in January and we'll have the same discussion.
We certainly will then. Let's talk about Matty Cash, because he tackled Rodrigo Bentancourt, someone who's just come back from an ACL injury. He was out for 9 months. He's going to be injured again. When you look at the tackle, there's been a lot of furore about this. Do you reckon Matty Cash left something in there to hurt him, or is it just more projected because of Tottenham's defeat?
I think I'd say, yeah, more projected because of the defeat. I personally didn't see much wrong with it. Again, I can understand those Spurs fans' fear, especially given that it is Bentancur and the injury that he's come back from, and you know, the added furore that, oh, he's, you know, picking on an injured player or whatever. I can understand that, but I didn't see much to be wronged with it personally.
Okay, if I was making a case for the prosecution, all I would say is that when Spurs went to Villa Park at the end of the 21-22 season, he also left it in on Matt Doherty, and he was out for a while on a Matty Cash tackle. So there's no smoke without fire, or am I just reading too much into this?
You'll remember Tottenham incidents more than I would, so I'll take your word for it. But yeah, there may, as you say, no smoke without fire. If it's becoming a pattern, then yeah, I mean, you'd have to go back and look at whether or not he's done the same to. Because he's not, I don't give him the reputation of a dirty player, honestly. But again, it might be that he just hasn't done it. He just hasn't done it against Fulham, so it's hard for me to notice that he's also done it to, for the sake of argument, Kieran Trippier, and for the sake of argument, Bruno Fernandes. He could have done so. I think again, it might be just a bit of a coincidence that he's had two bad tackles against Spurs, but I don't see any big pattern emerging, at least from what I've been able to see.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think I'm trying to scratch the surface and find something that isn't there. I think it'll be interesting when Tottenham go to Villa Park. I think Romero wasn't on the pitch for that game we just had a couple of days back. If he is on the field and Matty Cash is as well, that could be some form of self-retribution being handed out by the Argentine. We'll have to wait and see on that front. Let's also have a look at Manchester City and Liverpool. It wasn't really a fixture that lived up to the magnitude of a top-of-the-table clash. Why?
Perhaps, no, it wasn't.
You know, the 12:30 kickoff worked against it, but even in the build-up of the week, you kind of almost forgot it was on.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, Man City, Liverpool. You would expect, again, I don't know what the coverage was like on Sky back in the UK and whether or not there was a week's worth of build up. But yeah, coming off the international break, I can understand why they want to go with a big game to, you know, welcome back to football, because this is the last break until March or whatever. I can understand that, but yeah, it just didn't seem like the big games that we've had over the years where it's been like, oh, this could be the time to start. Maybe it's because of the fact that, you know, we're expecting, in the past couple of years, it was always, right, this is a key, you know, six-pointer for the title. But now, with how everything is, maybe it's because we are throwing the likes of Arsenal in, maybe people think Man United could be the thing, that this isn't the title decider that everyone, you know, expected to be. And maybe that's why it was a little bit, you know, a little bit downplayed as well, because this isn't going to be something that decides the Premier League no come May. So I think that might have played a part in it.
Yeah, from a UK point of view, it's just really flat build-up. Obviously, If it was a Super Sunday 4:30, it might have been more sort of sold in its more prominence by Sky. But it just felt like any other fixture. And it wasn't first versus second. And the history of these two clubs in, well, I say history, but the last 5 years at least, you know, these have been the two teams at the pinnacle of English football. It just didn't have any sort of, I don't know, window dressing around it at all, really. It was really flat. And I think that kind of fed into the game itself. Not a classic by any stretch of the imagination. 12:30 kickoffs never help. But I just, yeah, not, I guess also neither team really revved up because of the international break and players playing in midweek and jetting across the world. So that doesn't help either. Alisson had a bad game by his own standards. He's probably going to be injured for about 4 or 5 weeks due to a hamstring injury. He was perhaps lucky when City thought they went 2-0 up. In your eyes, Matthew, did Alisson get too much protection? Was that a legitimate goal or should it have been ruled out?
That was the first note I spotted, I think, because I sort of turned on. I turned on at half time, and that was the first sort of big highlight that I saw. I thought he got very, very lucky with that. Again, I can understand that goalkeepers get certain protections, everything, but I do very much buy the argument that if that same challenge or, you know, amount of contact happens, you know, on the halfway line between a defender and a midfielder, that gets blown off. That doesn't get charged as a foul. As a former goalkeeper myself, I always said we got a little bit too much protection. That was a perfect example of that. I think Alisson can consider himself very lucky that that got ruled out.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, it's frustrating from a football fan point of view that you see goalkeepers get that much protection. You think, come on, like, is that really a foul? I thought it was interesting, though, that no Man City player really took umbrage to the decision. They kind of just almost accepted it. Where really, you kind of think, you know, they should be at least castigating the referee, saying, look, why on earth have you given that? They kind of just got on with it and it caught them out minutes later when Trent Alexander-Arnold got the equaliser.
It was. I mean, maybe there is an element of, again, with all the talk about referee and respect, they didn't want to maybe go too hard in on the referee. Maybe it was also the fact that they felt that Liverpool didn't really challenge them. So they thought, okay, we've got the 1-0 lead. This isn't going to be, you know, in their eyes, maybe. They thought, oh, this is going to be a game changer. We can still win this. But then obviously, they said Trent Alexander-Arnold goes and equalises, you know, with a very good goal of his own.
Well, over here, Trent was given player of the match or man of the match, whatever you want to call it. If you watch the 90 minutes or even just the highlights, I mean, Jeremy Doku had him on strings for quite a long time. You know, his runs Doku was creating had Arnold in a lot of problems. So is it fair that just because he scored a goal himself, Alexander-Arnold, that overshadows his, not indifference performance in terms of defending, but he wasn't really a classic either. Was the goal good enough just to give him that award on its own?
I mean, it was a very good goal, but, you know, as you said, you know, I watched the second half and then a couple of the highlights as well. And as you said, Doku did give him the runaround for most of the game. So I think they may have been just very, very generous with their decision to give him man of the match. I think that's that was a bit of a stretch, even though it was, you know, a very, very well taken goal.
I guess the point you could make really is that it was a low benchmark because no one really played up to the standard you'd expect. I mean, Haaland's goal was good after a Nathan Ake run, but no one really went above and beyond what they could be doing.
I think that's a fair assessment. You know, as we said, the game wasn't exactly the great game that we've expected from these two over the years. So maybe that did sort of play a part in it, that, you know, the only real bright spark and the best moment was the one that, you know, was the one that sort of pipped over the edge for Alexander-Arnold.
And in terms of the Premier League landscape, do you reckon that's a better point for Manchester City or Liverpool?
I think Liverpool, because I think whenever you go into the opposition in the and are able to not lose, I think that's always a benefit. You know, Man City would have thought, you know, with home field advantage and everything like that, and, you know, Jurgen Klopp's always the one complaining about 12:30 kickoffs and the fact that his players aren't rested and all that lot. The fact that Liverpool were able to go in and get a point, I think it probably serves them better, because it just keeps Man City at bay rather than, you know, giving them that extra 2 points, which could be the decider come May.
Well, it's a draw there, and Arsenal go top after their win over Hounslow Town. Not a great game for the Gunners, but the perfect result in the end. Now, Matthew, if you were to look at Arsenal, would it be fair to say that they've swapped 10% of last season's style for 10% more grit and determination, and in the end of the season, that rebalance could be vital?
I think it could. I think that's what we always sort of said. No, even going back to last season, you know, Gary Neville sort of made the point when he was, I think, like, Arsenal were 5 points clear or whatever, but he still said Man City would win the title because he knows that Arsenal don't have the mental fortitude to get it done, and we proved, you know, and they proved that exactly. I think that's probably the with what Arsenal were looking for this season. Again, that great determination. Yes, they didn't win, you know, again, this game last season. You know, I think, in fact, I think they lost this game last season away to Hounslow Town. So again, they are swapping that, just that little bit extra, as you say, 10% of great determination to get to be able to grind out results. And hopefully that means that they're in a better mental state come the end of the season, when they could be finding themselves in a title challenge.
Now, in terms of the goalkeeper, it was Aaron Ramsdale in between the sticks on Saturday. He almost made a huge mistake in the first half. Well, he made the mistake, but it didn't lead to a goal. Now, neither he nor David Raya look confident at the moment when in goal for Arsenal. Is this the monster that Mikel Arteta has created?
Yeah, I think we sort of said that, and a lot of pundits have said that, that it is creating a bit of, you know, a little bit of nerve between the two goalkeepers of where they really do have to be on their toes, because there isn't the established number one where you can feel confident in being the number one. Whereas if you've got, you know, a 1A and, you know, a 1A and a 1B in effect, you know, you're always constantly looking over your shoulder, and you're always just a little bit nervous because, you know, that one mistake and all of a sudden he's back in the lineup. So it was always going to be a risky decision with Arteta when he made that move. And yeah, it is showing, because David Raya has not been was not perfect when he was in goal, and now Aaron Ramsdale is making his mental mistakes as well. And again, he got lucky on the weekend, but on another game that goes in the back of the net.
What did you make of Ramsdale's comments? I don't know if it was in the week or the week before, about his lack of concentration, about sometimes he has to just go and talk to fans because he can't focus for 90 minutes. That's, you know, that's maybe how his brain works, and fair enough if it does. But are they comments he should be making in the public domain, knowing that opposition teams can pounce on that?
Yeah, I can understand where it's coming from. Again, everyone has their own ways of, you know, being, of keeping calm or keeping themselves concentrated or whatever, or having their, like, in every walk of life has those moments. We all have our ways of dealing with it. But as you said, I think going into public with it, especially given the issues surrounding the goalkeepers, as you hinted, it does give opposition players just that little instinct to say, right, we know that he's not in the greatest situation in regards to the competition he's in with David Raya. Now we found another weakness that we can perhaps look to exploit. I don't think it was right for him to say in a public setting, especially given the hints that it's going to, and the advantages it can give to other players.
Yeah, it's a strange one, really. Unless you are rock solid as number one for Arsenal, when you're at risk of playing or not each week and you've got to really earn your position, you don't want to give any other team ammunition, and you've done it in the biggest forum possible of social media. So a strange one for me, but, you know, he got selected on Saturday. Arsenal won the game, so they move on. It was almost a disaster in goal for Ramsdale. It was a definite disaster for Chelsea on Tyneside. And it would be easy to say that Chelsea had an off day. There's no doubt about that. But because of that, is it also fair to say that Newcastle's win has been overshadowed by Chelsea's collapse, rather than Newcastle playing really, really well?
Well, you say Chelsea have an off day. They've had a couple of off days. If this is going to be the Chelsea that we expect, then I think we may need to, you know, as you talked about with Tottenham and ambitions, then we may need to reassess what is possible for Chelsea this season, whether or not, you know, Europe might be, you know, European football in any sense might be a bit too far for them. But yeah, as you said, part of it is you have to take advantage of the team when they are on their off day, especially if this is a team that you think, again, we think maybe could be challenging for Europe, and now Newcastle are able to dispatch them and show, right, we can be ruthless. We can be ruthless when we need to. And this was a perfect example of it.
Well, I mean, I guess from a Chelsea point of view, you've got a win over Tottenham. Obviously, Tottenham had 9 men on the pitch at the end of it, so a win is a win there. That breathless 4-4 draw with Manchester City, has the international break halted their momentum, and we've seen it kind of collapse on Tyneside?
I don't want to say collapse, because this is a Chelsea that can produce some very good results and have done very well at points this season. So it is just a case, you know, a bit like Arsenal last season. It's just, can they get that consistency through rather than having these bad days in the office? Because again, we wondered what sort of position they're in after they lost to Hounslow Town. I believe it was 2-0 at home. So we know that this is Chelsea. It's just a case of, you know, can they get themselves back to a consistent run where they're winning more games than they are, you know, than they are collapsing?
Pochettino's in the stands after getting 3 yellow cards beforehand. Do you reckon that had any bearing on Chelsea's performance, or are these professional enough to, you know, take instruction in the week and go and play the football? Or is it actually because they haven't got a manager barking those instructions from the sidelines, they were at a disadvantage?
I've never bought this argument, especially again in the modern day, because whilst he may not be on the sidelines, there's enough coaches down there that can relay the relay the message. And as you say, they had, well, not necessarily all week, because there would have been players away on internationals, but they would have had the week preparing and training ahead of it with Pochettino, so he would have been able to get the game plan and everything across, and adjustments he should be able to, you know, reconvene down to his assistants on the sideline. So I personally never bought that sort of argument. I can understand, you know, if like Conte, for instance, when he was completely away from the team, when he had his surgery or whatever it was last season, I can understand that, but not when you're still with the team in the week build up.
And I guess for Chelsea, in terms of their performance, their day was summed up by not only Reece James being sent off for two deserved yellow cards, but really a terrible performance from Thiago Silva, which is very much unlike him. But at the same time, it does show there's only so much you can keep squeezing out of the 39-year-old.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because, you know, the one moment that went viral on social media was the his attempt to get the ball out of the corner, and then his mistake for one of the goals later on. Yeah, whilst we understand that he may be a great leader and bring a lot in terms of captaincy and leadership and all that sort of stuff, when it comes to being actually on the pitch, he might well have just passed his peak, and it might be a bit harsh and a bit tough for Chelsea to have to consistently rely on someone like Thiago Silva to keep the job going.
Well, Burnley's beat run at Turf Moor continues. They've lost every game at home this season. And after the late reversal at the hands of West Ham, that's certainly going to smart for Vincent Kompany and his players.
Yeah, it will be, especially if you've got to think, right, you know, with that 1-0 lead, you've got to think, right, this is the chance we have to finally get a win under our belts, you know, stop the rot and everything at home. But if they can't grind out again, you can understand, okay, West Ham are a very good team in European football and all that stuff. We could at least get a draw. That would be fine. Again, not great, but that would be fine. To then go on and lose it, that's got to be a real... Again, I don't want to say this in November, but that's the kind of thing that if they can't at least get a draw out of that at home, then you've got to think, right, when are they actually going to be able to get some good results and get a good run of form together? Because if, you know, like this, they are walking straight into relegation. Not even a relegation battle, just straight into relegation.
Well, they always say that home form is integral to any relegation battle and survival hope. No points on the board at Turf Moor. That in itself has to be the biggest alarm for Vincent Kompany.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, you look at, you know, you can understand going away from home and not being great, but if you can't even win your home games, then what platform do you really have to build on? I think that's the worrying thing for Vince Kompany. If they can't get it done at home, then where else are they going to get anything done consistently?
No win for Burnley, but Brighton back in the winning groove. They finished their trip to the City Ground with 10 men, but also 3 points. So Lewis Dunk was sent off after making not one but two comments to Anthony Taylor. Comments that, when you look at the penalty award that went to Nottingham Forest, in the end were hardly merited by the Brighton defender.
It's one of the things Lewis Dunk should know better. Again, and this goes back to what I was saying about Man City earlier, is, right, this is the age of, you have to be careful with what you say to the, you know, to the referee. And Lewis Dunk, obviously, again, whilst he may argue with the decision, obviously we don't know exactly what he said, but obviously it was in the referee's mind, he stepped over the line, and you've just got to be careful. Again, Lewis Dunk may have been absolutely right with what he said, but if you're going on at the referee and, you know, in the way he did, you are always very, very close to crossing that line and getting yourself into trouble, as he found out.
Well, it's a two-match ban for Dunk, and he's going to be missed by Brighton, because although they did win at the weekend, before that, no win in six. Admittedly, a lot of those six were draws, so it wasn't really crisis for Brighton, but compared to last season, not quite hitting the same height. So is it fair to say that after winning against Nottingham Forest, they have shown the rest of the league what they are capable of still doing?
Yeah, they show what they're capable of, but I think for Brighton, I think this is still a year where they focus predominantly on European football, because this is, you know, the first time they've done it in their history and everything, and give them a good, you know, give them a good European run, because yeah, whilst they might sacrifice a couple of places in the league, you know, it's something that Brighton as a team are gonna, you know, are gonna be remembered for, you know, forever for going on a European run. So if it means they've got to sacrifice, you know, as you say, most of the no wins in six were draws, you know, but the fact is they're still doing, they're doing very well in their Europa League group. So it's, they're doing well. They've just got to spread their resources out that way, and they're just focusing on European football for now.
Yeah, I think that, well, actually, I know a few Brighton fans, actually, and they've sort of echoed just what you said, that yes, we are in the Europa League. We've got a squad that has been pulled in so many different directions. There's a lot of absences at the moment, that if we don't hit the same domestic heights and we have a really good run in the Europa League, then that's still a great season for us. You know, they could still win an FA Cup, for example. The season is far from done. I think that not every season as a club you can keep going up and up and up. You are going to get these pendulum swings from time to time, but as long as the trajectory over 3-5 years is still positive, you take these holding pattern seasons, or, you know, consolidation seasons at worst, I don't think there's going to be many, if any, complaints on the South Coast. Monday Night Football, of course, Fulham versus Wolves. Matthew, Wolves fans up in arms. You yourself, though, won't care too much, if anything, about those penalty calls for Fulham.
I won't care, but at the same time, I do feel for Wolves.
Yeah, you
I
have
think
to,
with,
don't you?
With the first one especially, that's a stonewall argument for what the call on the pitch is the most important one, because I think if that had been given as a non-penalty and then gone back to overturn, I don't think that gets overturned. But at the same point, you can see, right, he gave a penalty. You can see enough to understand why he gave the penalty. So I can completely understand with Wolves why they might feel aggrieved. Why they might feel aggrieved with that, because that was a very, very close one. The second one, I think, was the second one for us, I think, was a little bit more clear cut. But yeah, I can certainly understand the Wolves fans' frustrations with the first one, especially if they consider themselves to be, you know, in amongst those relegation people. Again, this could be something that, you know, I don't think it will cost them, because I think Wolves will still stay up. But just 2 points that they feel, you know, they feel like they might have deserved.
Well, Wolves fans are totting up, but they reckon they've got 7 points not awarded to them due to VAR decisions. Now, are they really, really unlucky? Is this Big Six bias working against them, that if they were Arsenal, Manchester United, those VAR decisions would go in their favour? Is this a bigger conspiracy at play? What do you make of Wolves' decisions going against them so many times?
I think I've said I don't believe in many of these conspiracy theories, but you do have to. But there is enough evidence. Like, I never believed in the UEFA conspiracy theory that they wanted English clubs to not do well in the Champions League. I remember that being an argument. I always said that was nonsense. But then I saw the Chelsea-Barcelona semi-final at Stamford Bridge and thought, hang on, they might be onto something. I don't believe in the Big Six bias and trying to keep the little clubs down and everything. But at the same time, as you said, 7 points being lost because of VAR. Again, I'm not saying that Wolves fans are onto something, but you can understand why they might be thinking that there might be something further afield with this. Especially, you know, in addition to that, Carlos Vinicius as well could have been given a red card for what he did, and it wasn't given. So, is there something? Again, I don't want to say there's an agenda against Wolves and the little clubs, but I can understand where they're coming from with the evidence that we've got.
I think the fact that Wolves are on 15 points and not 8 is not making it so much of an issue. You know, let's say Wolves got relegated at the end of the season and you totted up all those VAR decisions that went against them and they were a key factor to them going down. You'd think, hang on, something is perhaps at play here, or we are really, really unlucky. The fact they are still clear the relegation zone, it's an issue, but it's not as pertinent as it could be. So they'll be fine, as you say. I think, you know, the way they're playing football, it could even galvanise them saying, look, we're against the 12th player here. You know, we've got to work even harder. Who knows? But I think they'll be fine. You know, there's bigger teams at crisis. Forest, Palace, for example. So Wolves, yes, they've got to suck it up again, which is unfortunate for them. But come the end of the season, they'll look back and they'll just think, well, you know, it's just the season's ended. There it is. We're going to end now. But unfortunately, before we end, it's time to sort of say something about Terry Venables, because sadly, he's left us at the age of 80. For me, as a Tottenham fan and an England fan, he brought so much joy as a youngster. It almost feels like part of my youth has gone with him. I know he's only a football coach, but he meant so much to so many people. He's one of those players that commanded respect across the whole football spectrum, no matter who you supported, no matter the nationality, Matthew. He offered so much to the game, didn't he?
I think he did. Again, just because of when I started getting into football and everything, like, my first knowledge of Terry Venables was being a very bad manager at Leeds United. So I can't go back and reminisce about, you know, Euro 96, and I'm sure, no, you did well at Barcelona, I think. I can't go on and sort about say about that, but the outpouring of, you know, emotion and respect and everything that got, you know, I do know enough about Tony Ramos to know, again, before I knew him, that he was very well respected, everything like that. So I can understand, you know, the sympathies and everything that are coming along with, you know, Spurs and the fans, and, you know, what he would have, what he did give them when you know, when he was around.
Fantastically put, Matthew. I think a great coach, an even greater person, is the way you sum up Terry Venables as we end this show. So, Matthew, the admins are simple as thanking you for your time this afternoon. I hope you'll join me next time.
Yes, I will. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Right. Cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Sports Social Podcast Network.